pleased to be discussing a case on D&O insurance today, and our moderator is Charlie Goodrich of Goodrich and Associates. He specializes in restructuring and insolvency. Before launching Goodrich and Associates, Charlie was VP of Profit Center Reporting and Budgeting for State Street Corporation. Charlie also served as Chief Financial Executive for the Budget Rent-A-Car Corporation Eastern Region with over 90 stores from recently purchased franchises. Charlie holds an MBA in Finance from the University of Chicago and a Bachelor's Degree in Economics from the University of Virginia. Charlie.
Thank you. I think for this, you know, if you'd individually take the role of either, you know, your Martin in deciding on, you know, what is good D&O policy and what are the risks, or you're somebody advising Martin, it can go either way, the issues are the same. So I guess to start, how do you know the policy is a good policy?
Your question was, how do we know it's a good policy?
Yeah.
I don't think you'd get to this stage and you say, oh, by the way, is it good stuff? You'd already have checked it out, I believe.
Well, in this case, you know, he signs on. He says verbally, yes, I'll do it. But by the way, let me see the D&O policy. So now you have a D&O policy. How do you look at it? Know what you want to find.
But verbally, he's not committed.
He's verbally committed, but not contractually yet. He's put the qualifier in. Let me just check out the D&O policy.
Well, I know what I do before I join any board. I mean, I basically take the D&O policy, send it to an independent lawyer with nothing to do with the company, and have them vet it. And they're looking for certain things. They're looking for, is the coverage sufficient?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Do you have side A, right?
Right.
So it's types, it's amounts, it takes into account the amount of litigation that the company has had as well as the industry it's in, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the risk. The side A is important because in particular you're looking to make sure that, you know, if you get into a situation, the legal fees are paid up front, that nobody on the board is ever has to actually put out cash. So I always have a complete review done. I don't know what you're looking for in that question.
Well, you brought up one key point, which is to look at side A coverage. Because when things go bad, let me back up. There's side A, which directly indemnifies you as a director or officer. There's side B that indemnifies, reimburses the company for their obligation to indemnify you. And then there's something called side C, which is reimbursing the company for suits that kind of fit the category but are not directly against a director or officer. Problem with side B, there's lots of problems with side B. In my world, often there's no money. So, you know, when I take on a role where I have those type of responsibilities, I'm always looking at for side A coverage because that's what's going to cover me, and will also hopefully deter people once they realize how much is there.
Can you speak, mm-hmm, why would that deter people if they realize how much is there?
So if somebody, for what I do, and if you've been, you know, on a board,
which is insolvent companies,
right?
Or?
Insolvent companies,
okay,
for the most part. If you have, once they know you've got sizable defense costs, and it's going to be their nickel against, you know, and you're insured up front, and they got to spend their own money against you, the first thing they have to decide is, do they want to outspend your policy? And that often is enough to really stop anything other than, you know, a really strong suit. It encourages people to go into mediation or arbitration instead. But a nice, healthy defense fund stops most of the stuff.
Could you be a little more specific about what is a nice, healthy fund in terms of
dollars? You know, it all depends on the size, your own set of assets. In this particular case, between the core policy and the umbrella over it, it was a $30 million package.
30?
Yes.
30, sir.
Right. Which, given the size of the company and how much they were spending, was, I forget the numbers, but it was a relatively modest number.
Wasn't the, one of the factors to, if you're a company and you're seeking help with an insurance company to get the D&O coverage, there's a lot of factors that come in for them, isn't there, that have to do with your company and the risk that it takes for all sorts of things, its assets and liabilities, all kinds of things, before they come up with a customized, policy. And then there's a cost to your company for this. And so usually the company that's asking for this has attorneys that work to that end to protect the directors and officers, correct?
I have found it depends quite a bit. A lot of times it's done straight through the broker. In this particular instance, there was not a lot of involvement. They used a very good broker. That was the, the broker for the private equity firm involved. Also in the private equity world, I just saw this in an example of a much smaller company. They have their own policies, given the boards they're on and their exposure. So if you're not part of them, they don't have a great incentive to have high coverage levels. And so they might reduce that coverage level. So that's one of the other things you have to look at.
But isn't it really critical before anyone joins a board to really make sure that there is sufficient coverage? I mean, I've made that sort of a standard practice.
Yeah.
Because if somebody is really damping down in the levels, because there are many levels and many types of coverage, and if there isn't sufficient coverage, you can be in a boatload. Should there be a problem? There's always hiccups. Should there be a problem?
Right.
Risk.
It's your risk. So you need the dollars both to cover you, and you need the dollars to defer people. But then there's also the question: well, when do they actually kick in? And that's where you can get a lot of variety. Yes.
I'm also not clear, and I want to know more about what the nature of the risk is. There are two sort of alarms in here. One is that they're renting a bunch of software. And the other is the software itself isn't yet where they want it to be because they're not making any money yet, which means there's some more development. And I don't know in this business to what extent the firm is liable for an algorithm that generates a systematically bad result, as an example, and what the leverage is on that, the exposure is on that. And then what's the exposure I have to the software that I'm renting? I'd probably want to look at the contracts I have with the software I'm running and the contracts I'm signing with the people who are my customers. And there's a lot of really uncertainty with this amazing financial exposure, which would worry me.
This was, it's what a little more precise of what they're doing is the software allows them to test algorithms. And so they're constantly building statistical algorithms on the fly based on getting very, very fast market data access and then buying slower retail order flow and trading off of the information in that order flow. So they have contracts and obligations with all the stock exchanges.
Still working.
Because couldn't you then, even if that algorithm is not involved in it, it's not involved in any trading, you could still blame the knowledge of that algorithm for a bad trade, right?
Well, they're trading on their own account, so they're trading for themselves. I mean, they're doing is executing somebody's order. So someone comes in and says, I want to buy IBM at $100 a share, and they say, okay, here it is. What they're doing off of that information is trading real fast above or below that share price. And those profits, if they have any, go to the owners of the firm. Yes?
Could we go back to yours and Ellen's comments? Is it the audit, from the board perspective, how frequently should you review your coverage, and we're going back a couple of sentences after some discussion. And is it, Ellen, is it the audit committee that's responsible for that, reporting to the board?
Well, I'll just say, every company I've been at, it's been, you know, it hasn't always come through the audit committee, so no. It's of such importance that I would say every board I've been on in the last 10 years, I go back 15 years and it was different, but certainly in the last 10 years, because the possibility of litigation is so great, highly probable, that the whole evaluation of D&O policy usually occurs, at least in my experience, it's once a year at the board. I don't know what your experience is.
It's typically once a year at renewal. I think one of the key things that gets overlooked is reviewing the actual review over, you know, renewal documents. Because that's a period where you have to disclose anything that's new. And the biggest way out for an insurance company is to say, well, you didn't disclose it. You must have known. And a lot of times, you know, you can have situations that the board may know about, but the person renewing the policy has no idea about. Yes.
As it relates to assessing risk, because the conditions are changing, is that typically part of this effort, and how is that accomplished? Does the board hire someone to evaluate risk, to look at, okay, there were changes in the market, we bought several companies that introduced some new things. How is that done? I helped somebody recently, took over, was a chief information officer, took over the responsibility as chief security officer, and they had to establish a board dialogue around cybersecurity, and it's clear that world is exploding. So obviously the risk profile, and this is a company that does a lot of work for the federal government.
Okay.
So there are nation states are a target. They're a target of nation states. So their situation's changing a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess my question would be, how does that get accomplished, and how do I do the risk analysis in order to then figure out how things have changed relative to D&O?
You know, my recommendation is to have an outside, you know, risk consulting firm look at it. Not a broker. It can be a broker that also performs that role that's independent of your existing broker. And I think in particular you need to look at really three things. You know, one is what's changed in your particular company. What's changed in the world of litigation and exposure, and what's changed in the insurance markets of perhaps new coverages that you might want, minor changes, things about the particular carriers. So, for example, if you go a couple years ago, there was something at the end of the Obama administration called the Yates Memo that basically encouraged boards of public companies to throw the CEO and officers under the bus. So they have, you know, great incentive to find a way not to identify you, not to insure you. And there's a substantial risk that some judge or, you know, someone's going to go after the insurance company so you can't defend yourself. What came out was foreign insurance companies issued drop-down coverage that would step in if the underlying coverage couldn't be, you know, wasn't going to pay out. And the basic thing is they agreed to be covered by any foreign entity or country that does not recognize the United States. So there's, you know, that's one big, you know, example. But there's lots of other little examples. Looking at the situation, you know, and particularly in this particular example, you know, what's really kind of gearing up is when things go wrong, there's a great tendency in the private equity world to say, well, couldn't be me. And more importantly, I need some cover with my limited partners, because in this case, they just lost $60 million, right? So they almost always go after the prior CEO and management team. So now you've got one, you have a couple things you have to be careful about. They have to get past all the indemnification provisions that they've already agreed to. And in this particular case, they have to get past all of the documents that they signed off on and agreed upon when they put money in. So they're going to charge something outrageous, typically securities fraud. So now a lot of policies, as soon as it's something like that, a couple things pop up. One, it's insured versus insured, and most D&O policies will not cover that because they don't want to insure directors suing each other. In this particular case, they did have insured versus insured defense costs. You want to have, besides the insured versus insured, you want to have that it's just covered. Sometimes a lot of policies say as soon as it becomes, quote, criminal or potentially criminal, no, you know, we don't touch that. Well, that's probably, in this case, how they're going to try and go after you. So you want to have, you know, lots of stuff that you say, well, I don't need that, but all of a sudden it becomes very important. In this particular case, they own 60%.
Because most of what I think of are public companies with all the public company laws that sort of essentially provide some protection for directors if they follow certain rules and processes and procedures. So there's some.
The key is the defense, there's the defense cost and the internal dynamics change once you have an actual situation, particularly if. Say in this case, the private equity firm controls the company. They have a great incentive to find a way to not to find a way to not indemnify the director or the former CEO.
Can I read talk a little bit more about the former CEO that's getting sued?
Yep.
And you said that basically we're going to charge him with fraud.
Right.
And what's his protection at the time he's exiting when he's got his? He's had his stock cut, he's been thrown out of the company, et cetera. It's not a good day for him. He's got his attorney. What would you suggest?
Well, this particular case was dicier than that, actually. Because he was the founder and the agreement with the private equity firm was that he was going to be on the board. So he was still on the board and on the board calls as we're liquidating the company. So he saw what's going on. But his, you know, he's, a lot of cases you are thrown out for the more traditional private equity model. So, you know, he needs to have the side A coverage that's going to step in. The other risk that you have is, well, so what's an actual threat and claim? Do you actually have to have been, you know, a lawsuit filed? In this particular case, they would threaten with draft lawsuits through the process. On the insurance side of things, I saw part of their, quote, complaint, which if they had ever publicly filed it, the limited partners would probably get upset because it basically they admitted that they didn't do good due diligence. This particular good policy was very open in terms of what constituted a claim. As soon as you had anything with an email exchange that was threatening under this policy, you were covered. The other key thing on the policy that I really learned in this particular example is what's really critical is who you don't talk to until you need them, which is the claims people with your broker. So in this particular case, they had a whole group dedicated to D&O claims, and they worked with the ex-CEO's attorney to write the claim to submit to the insurance company to make it highly likely that they would in fact be insured. And that's a piece that's very critical. That's also the piece that, you know, when I'm starting to look at new D&O policies, yeah, I want to talk to someone that I know that I trust, perhaps an attorney, but I also want to talk to someone in their claims department and, you know, flat out ask them, what else should I have? You know, this type of thing. That also, so that one gets their feedback, but that also gives you to get a sense of, well, how good are they if I need them? Because if they, you know, if the insurance company doesn't accept the claim, you know, then you got to go litigate to get them to accept the claim.
Sure. This is several years ago, but I was told by people that I respect that Chubb is really the company you want to be insured by for D&O. They really stand by their contracts. Mm-hmm. They're good. They're honorable. They're decent. And I've heard of other companies that mm-hmm. look for every way to weasel out of the contract. Are there any? Does Chubb still have that reputation, and are there insurance companies that your experience you find better than others? And let me ask other people their experiences too, because it's not only what's on the contract, but who's covering the contract.
Right. I think it varies quite a bit. and it changes over time. You know, Chubb, for example, was bought up by somebody 5 or 10 years ago. So they may have changed. That is part of you know, what you should be looking at. But a lot of it's, what's the coverage? You know, Chubb may not offer the coverage you want.
Anybody else have insurance companies that they particularly like or not recommend?
I think it doesn't matter as much. There is, you know, and other types of policies, you know, there's certain companies that find a way to deny coverage, and they're known for that. But, you know, particularly in the larger company, and if you don't cover claims, the word gets out and then people don't use you. And I found this across the board in various types, different types of insurance coverage where I thought, oh, they're never going to pay. And in fact, if you meet the requirements, they do. And they want, you know, they're more than willing to pay. They might, you know, internally they might not be happy about it, but they want to preserve their reputation. They know if you have a valid claim, we're going to pay.
So, Larry, just a side note, my experience has been it's more about the contract. So it's about the negotiation up front, what clauses you actually have in and what is covered and what is not covered.
In your D&O insurances and the ones you look at, you get to pick your own attorneys or do the insurance companies pick the attorneys, and does it make any difference?
Typically, you have to use somebody that's on the, if you want to, if you don't want to pay for it yourself, you have to use somebody that is on their panel of defense attorneys.
Okay. You know, on the, so you do your reviews, annual reviews, right? People get lazy and they renew their insurance, they update it, and they kind of roll it forward. How often do you recommend actually bringing in competitive bids? Because it seems like you know, you, because you generally have ongoing actions within the policy, and then you have to keep that there. Then if you go to a different company, then you have to make sure that stays there and that the other company is looking at it. But it's like buying auto insurance, right? It's like,
I think a lot of it would be, that's the advantage of having an outside risk consultant, because they should know the market if they're any good. And they can, you know, they should have a sense of that. They can have a sense of various carriers are changing some of their underwriting standards, and you might want to make a change now if they're starting to pull back from certain types of coverages, all those types of things.
Because I agree. I mean, the coverage is the most important thing, but it's so easy just to continue to, because there's generally something going on with the company that you're already insured and to just keep rolling it forward and updating it. And you don't, like I say, it's like auto insurance. I mean, unless you're diligent every 5 years to look and see that you can save however much money you can save, you just stay with it, right? And you don't go explore the market.
And the market changes. Market changes a lot.
What's the experience of when you're covered, when you're no longer on the board? How long does that usually last on those policies that you hold back?
That's going to be policy dependent, but typically as long as the company's around, you know, it should last. That's been, you know, my experience and my understanding. The key is when you end, is you want to buy something called tail insurance. And that's, you know, ideally you want 6 years. Most people, carriers won't offer more than that. A good policy should also have that priced in the policy. And that's a critical piece, because that's, you know, that stuff, all this stuff takes a while to percolate.
So could we go back to Director Lee and Marianne's example? She buys the tail insurance, or it's
bought, purchased by the company.
So the company pays for her for as long as they're in existence.
Yep.
But if the company's going out of business, you want to also make sure that they're buying that tail
insurance
before they go out of business.
Right.
Yeah, I had that situation with a client of mine. What's that? And that it's paid out.
Yeah. Okay. Yep.
So I've got this nightmare fantasy that the board is told, you know, D&O insurance is fine, and Ellen gets a second opinion in 2019, it's fine. And then we assume the CFO is going to be on top of this and will be updating this. But of course, the CFO's got a big laundry list of things
to do,
and it's not at the top of the list. And then it's now 2025. and it hits the fan and the CFO wasn't watching it when, do boards depend on the CFO to be doing this, or do the boards do it?
Do you individually go through your process every single year to make sure that the policy is still as valid as it was last year?
I'm Charlie C.
So, my situations are typically a little bit different because I'm on or being insured for a particular period of time. And I'm almost always buying the tail policy for what I do. I think people need to review it. I personally always make sure that I get a certificate back from the insurance company saying that yes, you're on the policy, and I individually my name and am insured. That for what I do, that can
Charlie,
be.
Charlie, let me ask. Yep. Are you talking about you, Charlie,
yep.
or
as a consultant,
the board, or the who in the company is doing that reviewing?
When I come on, I always review it myself. And what I would recommend, I think you need to have, an outside risk advisor review your policies. But to be safe, I would always ask for something from the insurance carrier with the policy that says, yes, I'm a named insured.
I think the difference with a public company, a traditional public company, is I don't ask for certificates. It's right in our proxy that the directors are covered. It's very laid out, the coverage. I mean, anybody worth their salt who's trying to sue the public company can go in and find the layers and, mm-hmm. So the information is all there. Who's covered. So it's very public. Now, your question on the CFO is an interesting one. I think 20 years ago or whatever, it was always, you got to get it done and it was always on the pile. Now the risks are so high and people are so focused on the risks that a good CFO is looking at it. But for all my boards, we do have, to the question that was asked over here, is we always have somebody, a third party, and it may not be exactly mm-hmm. your risk consultant, but we always have a third party come in and tell us about changes in sort of what you call best practices or coverages that we need to be looking for in our policies and showing us where they aren't in our policies. So looking for those gaps. And that's the analysis that is presented to the board with the what is the coverage changing to, and now what do the layers look like and what are the different sides look like and so forth. So
let me turn this conversation to Jim. Because you're talking about public companies. That's fine. Jim knows the nonprofit world. They also have risks too. They also get sued as well. You're also on the board of a community bank. Did what Ellen say apply to that world?
It does, and it concerns me that I have not done certain things that I probably should have. I'm not worried about it because how well run this particular organization is. However, that doesn't excuse me for not doing my own doing.
Now you're glad you came to the seat of the table.
Yeah, there's one piece, and you can jump in that I have liquidated a nonprofit that had some very, it was backed by a bunch of large hospitals in New York City. And some of the issues you faced there was all of the directors were working for these large hospitals, and they had these huge insurance policies that indemnified any employee that was on a board, et cetera. And because they took all their frustration out on the CEO, they didn't want to write a check to fund the tail coverage for it.
I wanted to hear about that because they don't like Mary Ann, so she's been gone for a year. Let's just not renew that part. That's got to be pretty common motivation.
I think you have to comply with your internal documentation, yeah. I suspect the insurance company isn't going to offer that coverage. And that's kind of asking you're already taking an underwriting mess, right? If they're trying not to indemnify somebody.
I just assume the worst in man in this
yeah.
case, and she's going to be left out there on her own.
Yeah,
but that's okay. I'm glad to see that.
But, you know, the bigger risk is that they don't pull the tail.
Lisa, you were or still are on the board of a well-known national nonprofit. What about DNO there? I mean, if stuff blows up, it could really blow up.
Yes, what you said.
What's the procedure in that board?
Well, no.
How well do board members know?
There is not due diligence. There is not the due diligence that Ellen describes is not in place in the nonprofit world.
I think their concern
is the litigation, though. I'm sorry, yes. Just to finish the thought, though, the litigation is so. There's definitely a disconnect. There's an opportunity for improvement in nonprofit land.
It's probably a huge opportunity. I think most board members of nonprofit, I'm actually in more of the smaller nonprofit boards that I see, but everyone's concerned about making sure that they're identified, but I'm not sure any of them necessarily go through the due diligence of actually examining the policy and making sure that's appropriate, or making sure that the insurance carrier, I mean, think about what nonprofits do. They try to get away with as cheap as they can get. And so, you know, if you're not picking the wrong carrier that doesn't pay claims, I mean, that's probably equally as important as understanding
or writing the contract, right?
That's
really the whole thing, right?
Yep.
Charlie, yes. Can you just throw something in here? I'm sitting here refreshing my memory because it was 12 years ago. When I started up a company, it was in the commercial fire sector.
Okay.
We're a manufacturer. So you can imagine, this equipment could go in a building that's worth $2 billion. If something goes wrong, the insurance companies point fingers and they'll sue everybody, including us, who are starting the company. So what I did was, at first I rang up a number of companies, including, I think, Chubb, Fidelity, and some others, and they sent me documents, and they just didn't fit my business, not to my thinking. So I did some research, and I ended up hiring a person specialized in writing insurance, an underwriter who worked for some of the big companies. I met with him, went through all my concerns, and he actually created a customized D&O policy for me. And then we sent it out to like five companies to bid on it. And then they all came back with different quotes and a couple changes here and there that they didn't like, and we went back and forth. And then ultimately we picked one that we thought was best for us, and that's what I did.
Okay, good.
I don't know if that's common, but that's...
I don't think it is. I mean, I haven't heard of it. But that does, yeah.
One of the things I found this year was in Massachusetts, there are no companies that will cover D&O insurance in healthcare. So you have to go out of state. And when you get the bids, then the Attorney General's office or someone lets you know that the state will not stand behind you if anything goes wrong. It makes you very nervous. My assumption was it didn't matter if it was an out-of-state insurer.
I think that's more or less true. Okay. There's a whole thing with insurance, you know, of something called surplus lines, where there's certain companies that say, we're going to do this kind of insurance in Massachusetts, and they're regulated. And then there is the so-called surplus market that's not regulated.
So that's what, that's
what
it is.
Yeah, that's probably part of it.
Yep.
One of the other things that surfaced that was an interesting twist in this particular case was the private equity firm was going after the CEO. CEO filed with his attorneys a claim for indemnification. This kind of business is in New York, and lots of various expensive New York attorneys wrote all the documents that were so-called experts. This liquidation went through something called a statutory Delaware liquidation, and the only important thing about that for this is that meant I was using Delaware attorneys. The way his claim was written, and when they read the documentations with their understanding of Delaware law, there were lots of gray areas. Things were not clear. No, this is probably not indemnified. This sets a precedent. We need a board meeting. This guy is still on the board. This particular case, I said, look, I'll get you covered. Don't worry about trying to get the company to go through this motion. But the big learning I had was, if you're, quote, indemnified under Delaware law, and someone tells you that, if they don't litigate and practice in Delaware Chancery Court, they really don't know. Unless, when I went through this process on the legal side, I'm always accompanied by a tag team. One's that's an entity expert, so they understand the laws in Delaware around that particular type of entity structure. And they, for what I do, they understand very well, they know how to understand the laws and read all the documentation of what can you actually do or not before, say, you need a shareholder vote or something like that, which can be important. And they're teamed up with a litigator. And once you have a litigator looking at it, who is looking at, you know, how we would defend this, how we would, you know, taking either side type of thing, whatever, what you think is very black and white, very quickly become very gray. And that, in the end, is the other big reason why the A-side coverage is so important. Because at the end of the day, what you thought was covered, it might not be. It might take time. You might have to litigate the company to get it covered. So you want to have A-side coverage that covers specific things, irrespective of what happens with the company.
We are almost, we're almost at time. Questions?
Can we ask to drop down off the board? Mm-hmm. I want to talk about the employees. Mm-hmm. Say a gender issue. Are one employee sues another employee because of let me give you a scenario. Female supervisor counsels a male subordinate. Second time around, mm-hmm. Three-stage process. No witness. She goes on her trip, he goes out and tells his bud down at the bar, she put her hand on my knee and asked me to come over tonight for a glass of wine. What do you think? All right? Does he have, the one that lied, let's say she's pretty much destroyed or lost her credibility, does she have the right to sue him, and will the insurance company pay for that?
Anybody, what I've learned is,
right.
It doesn't matter if you have the right, anybody right. can sue, right? So that's number one. Number two is D&O typically would not cover this at all because that's employer employer employment practices type policy.
Right.
And so that's the kind of policy you got to look for to cover that.
D&O is specifically director and
officer. Right.
But what if it was a CEO or someone who was a company employee who was on the board? And that same scenario happened, would that not be covered under
It's
going to
depend
insurance?
On the language of the policy, but okay, most D&O policies are going to say, no, that's okay. Employer liability okay. policy.
So I was wondering in your area, the social media aspects or the media, if you guys are running across situations that companies normally don't have at the board level, but they send the wrong message out, somebody's abusing it, somebody's bullying them, et cetera, inside the company environment. So I know you don't mm-hmm. cover that from the D&O standpoint, but there's got to be some nefarious activities going on there that cause backlash. Are you hearing that?
No, I'm not. But I mean, to your point, though, of there's all kinds of, I think, some additional policies that you take out for content creation or the use of that content after you put it out there. I mean, we're covered on all the content that we do, whether it's something that's produced or whether it's something that you're in the process of a podcast, for example, and you're just spouting off different things. But to your point, I mean, there's so much that I'm not really sure, that I am up to speed all the time on every aspect of even those kinds of insurance policies, or even I was on a, and this is on a different subject here, but I was on a nonprofit board where there was a situation where someone in the organization was suing for actions that were taken by it was a group home, and something apparently happened within the home, so one of the people in the home were suing. And I remember at that point, I raised the question about, what's the coverage like? And they said, well, we're covered. And I was fine with that. We're covered. I didn't ask for anything. I didn't look at it. I didn't know to what extent we were covered. But, I'm sitting here thinking, wow.
I think if any of us are on nonprofit boards, yep. we have to get a copy of that policy personally.
Yeah. Yep.
I have it reviewed. I think you can't trust anyone to say I'm covered.
And I think if you've learned one thing in this session, it should be that. If you go to our website, boardoptions.com, go to From Ideas to Action, where we have the podcasts of previous programs, and scroll down, you'll see one of our first programs is about, I think it's about a hospital, and the chairman of this nonprofit hospital comes and talks about the case. What it was a nonprofit hospital is really going through very difficult times, and is approached by a for-profit hospital that would acquire them. Now, for those of you who are in healthcare in Massachusetts, know that for-profit healthcare sector is sort of viewed in a very negative light, because nonprofits are good and for-profits are bad, don't you know? And so this board decided that rather than go with the devil, they would go bankrupt. And Bank America had lent the hospital money, and they sued the board members
for that decision.
To go with the best deal.
Wow.
And they thought they had adequate D&O insurance, and they didn't.
So the one thing I would say to your comment, though, is if there's never been a review, then every director's got a need, right? And there are groups, and I can think of a couple of them, that if it's a full board review, they'll actually do it. Basically, the charge is either nothing or de minimis, because it gives them the opportunity, and they will come in, they'll look at your policy versus what the standard is, and tell you where all the gaps are.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it's a starting place. It's a big starting place, because then it's only arguing about how much coverage do you want. You make sure that at least the key areas of risk at least are covered in the policy, right?
I'm on the board of a small nonprofit, and they work with children, and the actions of the nonprofit could actually result in the death of a child because of the nature of the business that they're in. And so I'm sweating bullets right now, wondering whether or not I have any personal liability in the case of that happening.
I tend to write checks and not sit on boards for this exact.
Well, I don't agree to any new nonprofit boards, but that's
It's also fun to read if you're on a board in the renewal process, and you do. I mean, generally you're reviewing the policy itself, it's this much money, and you know, mm-hmm. It's also kind of cool to read the underlying document, the actual application, the updated application, as a review to see, as management has put forth to the insurance company, what's actually happened in the last year. It's a good little review process, not just for that insurance, not just for D&O, but for any insurance, and you can find out that, geez, I didn't know we had 75 trucks, I thought we had 30, you know, so why are we spending that money? Or you might find out that there's a couple of things listed here that you hadn't visited in the last 6 or 7 months
as a
board.
I'm drinking a lot of wine.
I know.
I mean, because even for me, it's hard reading those things, and I'm thinking, you're thinking
but,
it's fun.
No, the application is fun. The actual policy stinks, but the actual application will say any changes in these different areas in the last year, and it's easy to read. I mean, they've listed out, and you, it's a good refresher, or maybe you find something that you didn't know about as a board member, which is kind of cool place to find it. So.
And is this information that shows up elsewhere in other documents, or this?
No, not
the
application. The application is something that most cases the CFO would fill out.
The information, would it be in various different places in company? For example, the 75 trucks, you may not know about it, but it is somewhere else.
Yeah, and that's a different insurance policy than the D&O. But but it would be someplace else. So it would be on your asset ledger.
Right. But you have to go digging around for all that. Here you can find out a lot in one.
Sure.
That's interesting. Right?
So I've started.
Who has a company car? That's always cool.
I've got a new client that's a couple million dollars to service his business. And
that
I'm working with. Yes, no, I wish. And the CEO has a lot of the information in his head.
Yeah.
The records associated with his business are kind of few and far between. So now I'm acting as a consultant. No, I'm acting as a consultant to this business, but it's fascinating because when you talk about this would be written down somewhere, and that was my experience with most of the people that I've worked with, and this one, it's a lot of it's in this guy's head, and I'm thinking,
So, and you, you know, he's got a growth mandate for the business that's fairly aggressive, but I'm kind of fascinated because it, you know, it's not even, I've got one of the people that, I'm the virtual CMO, I've got one of the people just trying to chase him down so we can get this information and start to capture it someplace rather than in this guy's head. So that's a good assumption, depending upon the business, and I just raised that because it may be a smaller organization that's got a relatively high degree of risk, and you'd expect this stuff to be written down somewhere, but it may not be. In which case, okay, now I've got a whole different set of issues and what's your exposure. I'm not on the board, I'm a consultant to it, but it's just reminded me of, okay, you know, I'm used to companies having this stuff down and competent CFOs that have really good records and accounts, you know, when you've got your financial systems and so forth, and I'm like, so how does some of this stuff get done?
And as a consultant, do you have insurance for yourself?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's good.
So how did it end up?
So in this particular case, they, you know, the guy that's the role of the chairman was chairman the whole time. They got rid of the CEO was pushed aside at the beginning of the year. I got involved around June. The CEO has been in the business and was, you know, very knowledgeable. They tried changing the algorithms to see if it would work. At the same time, they started a sale process. Sale process didn't really work, and they had a very high burn rate because, you know, all these people are very expensive. They had a very a nice thing about this is I had a nice office overlooking Rockefeller Center and all this good stuff. One floor was completely empty that they never filled up. And so, you know, I was brought in to do this liquidation. The private equity firm was going after the CEO. The CEO wanted to buy some of the underlying technology, still does, but had his friends make an offer of, well, if the private equity firm agrees not to sue me, I'll buy it. Obviously, I can't speak for the private equity firm. The lead investor for the private equity firm, towards the end of the case and the wind down, decided to have a career change. Everybody inside the company was convinced, no, he's good. He's good. I said, no, he's not. He actually thought that after liquidation, he was going to end up with $15 million. I sold the technology, the so-called enhancements, which in the end were not very much, and some market data to the former chief technical officer for $3,500. Those was the crown jewels. Sold the market data to both him and the New York Stock Exchange. Got only 30 grand. He did have live trading data to the millisecond, which in that world is very valuable. It was so, normally in something like this, you back everything up forever. The storage costs would just even with Amazon and Google for what was the equivalent of half a, 500 petabytes, whatever that is. You know, it took 2 weeks to put the data onto the Amazon cloud with special drives that were mailed to them. The guy has since come, you know, they finally settled. His lawyer tried to drag me into it. And that's where it was very convenient to say, you know, I'm on this policy and so is your client. The private equity firm, they had talked to their insurance guy through their lawyer who was going after him and said, you know, you need a different approach because you're going to have to go through $30 million first. And so it went into some form of binding arbitration or something like that. The CEO did file a claim to try and get his defense costs back. He was, you know, on the board meetings with all the liquidation, but he waited till all the money went out. And what really came up was, you think all these corporate documents matter, but they don't, because it was very gray if whether he would be identified for something like this. In part because the private equity firm needs to have something, is trying to get past all that to begin with. So they're trying to find to charge something that the company's not going to indemnify him for. So that, you know, that was the part of it. And it really reinforced to me that, you know, the side A coverage is what you're really flying on. And it kind of reinforced another thing I've learned through time, is when it comes to using lawyers, you know, they all say they can do everything in Delaware, but if you're doing something in Delaware law, have a Delaware lawyer do it. Particularly for the bigger companies, Delaware, the Delaware rates are about half New York rates. They're very good. They practice on it. You know, if you're going to do something in this case, you know, they had a lot of stuff under New York law. You know, have a New York law lawyer look at it, and a New York litigator. You know, one of the things that surfaced was the first week I was there, we had a little over $10 million in cash, and we had less than five when I left the first week, because all of the employment agreements were written in such a way that under New York law, the guaranteed salaries were considered wages that the directors and officers would be personally liable for. So boom, $5 million went out like that, in part because no one had ever really looked with a New York employment lawyer, what are these contracts? It's pretty clear the CEO did, but they hadn't.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have judiciously decided not to compete against Christmas, and so our next meeting is going to be in the new year in January, and we look forward to seeing you. We wish you all a wonderful Thanksgiving and a great holiday, and see you in the new year.
Thank you.
Thank you.